You are listening to Keystone Stock Talk Show, episode 247.
If this is your first time listening, then thanks for stopping by. This podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment, and show notes are found at www.keystocks.com. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or on iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Keystocks and on Facebook, and keep submitting your stocks via the usual social channels or at our website, keystocks.com, for our Your Stock Our Take segment. And we just might review your stock in an upcoming show and let you know if it is a buy, sell, or hold.
It's great to be back with you again this week. We kick off a show with a review of our research conference trip to California and the Roth Conference. I hit the mailbag to answer a viewer question on Dye & Durham Limited, symbol DND on the TSX, a provider of practice management software, data solutions, and payments technologies to law firms and businesses. The viewer asks us if this is a potential turnaround story and if it has any value today. Aaron answers a viewer question on Lululemon, symbol LULU on the NASDAQ. The athletic footwear and accessories apparel company saw its share price drop last week after a strong run. Aaron lets you know if the drop is an opportunity or a sign of things to come. Brett answers a viewer question on RCM Technologies, RCMT on the NASDAQ. A staffing solutions company. The viewer asks if the company is seeing a catalyst for expanding into different regions like South America, and as well if the company possesses a moat. Finally, Brennan has put together a segment on the VIX, or the CBOE Volatility Index, which was launched in 2003 and is known as the Fear Index. Never fear, Brennan is here to demystify the VIX.
Investing in just two or three truly great stocks in your lifetime can be game-changing for your portfolio. Unfortunately, you will not hear this from most Canadian advisors. A portfolio built in this manner owns 500 to thousands of stocks and will mirror the market because it is the market and will underperform due to those high fees. But there is a better way. Attend one of our live upcoming webinars and we will show you how to design a simple 15 to 25 stock portfolio designed to save on fees and position your portfolio to benefit from great capital compounding stocks. We will also give you 6 to 8 growth and dividend growth stocks you can buy today. I look forward to seeing you and wish you profitable investing.
So let's get to the show. I'm going to welcome my co-host, Mr. Aaron Dunn, the Killer Bees, Brett and Brennan. How are you guys doing? Have you recovered from our trip down to California? A good trip. 20 plus interviews, but it can be taxing.
Yep.
As Brennan, who's a little under the weather, will tell you.
Yeah, I'm a little sick. And I can sure say I'm sick of the airlines or WestJet in particular, because I mean, the last 5 times that I've traveled, I've been delayed every single time. And I mean, it probably has something to do with me being in Saskatchewan and I always have to, you know,
just a little
take another layover flight. But either way, you know, our flight was delayed in LA. So, you know, that was kind of a pain.
And then snowballed.
You were delayed in LA, so you missed your connection from Calgary to Saskatoon, and you're stuck there overnight.
Yeah, so I was stuck there overnight. So I call Ryan at midnight. I'm absolutely bawling my eyes out.
You were crying.
No, I wasn't crying. But I was pissed. That's Ryan can vouch for that. I was pissed. I was giving him an earful, not about him or anything, but just about the airlines.
So Air Canada doesn't operate out of Saskatoon anymore. Is that true?
I think that is true, or at least the last several times that I've flown, it's always been WestJet.
Wow.
Which is unfortunate. And yeah, I had a lot of people that weren't happy. And
I'm sure.
Yeah.
You had some good conversations though, right? You said on the...
Yeah. I had some really good conversations.
You had a lot of time.
I was making friends.
Right?
Yeah. I met this one lady in Halifax and some people from Prince Albert, where I'm originally from. And someone who's actually on the island, on Vancouver Island, and is moving to Edmonton. So, you know, I was I was getting familiar with a lot of people, which
Brennan's
was funny.
Never lost for words, so he makes a lot of friends, right? It's good.
Yeah.
It's good. It's
yeah,
good.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, at least you could talk to some people and you weren't just completely to yourself. That's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. But
sorry. Anything else?
Well, I was
else?
Just going to say, actually going to the conference itself, you know, I thought that it was good. A lot of really good meetings. Some companies actually in coverage, which we are going to be updating clients on a couple of those names as well. And I'll let you kind of go on, Ryan, if you were going to say something.
Yeah, for sure. We sat down with at least, I think, four names, companies that are in coverage right now, or either that or close to being in coverage. Some companies we're definitely monitoring closely to see if there's an opportunity here. And then, you know, some initial meetings with about 12 companies that, you know, we potentially we're starting some dialogue with and potentially could be some recommendations in there over the course of the next year. Certainly some companies that, you know, you sit down with management and then you put an X there. You say, like, this is probably not going to be a company we
It's like speed dating, right?
Yeah. It's like
yeah.
when you go through, maybe
the time just flies. Yeah. But when you, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. some companies, you're looking at the clock. Yeah. Although I'd say there's really only a couple.
There's only a few that we yeah. look and they go, oh,
we've got them
that
pretty
was 5
well
minutes only? Oh, my
there.
God. How are we gonna do 25 more minutes here? We got nothing else. So then you go through. But there was a couple companies that definitely were in that category where, you know, 5 minutes in, you say, all right, this isn't going to work. We're not going to be investing in this or having our clients put any of their money in this. And you got to kind of run out the clock, right? And that's always
and
fun.
And then Ryan says, it's not us, it's you.
Yeah, it's you. Not us, it's you. It's not yeah. me, it's you. No, it is me. Trust me.
That's yeah. Like I won't say the name of the company, but there was one, you know, CFO who ended up saying, you know, our stock's absolutely in the toilet, you know, and then we ended up asking, well, are you comfortable at raising? Are you guys looking at raising? These guys are serial raisers, raising equity. And, you know, they went on to say, yeah, we're comfortable raising right now. After, you know, he literally just told us that, you know, it's the time to buy and the stock is, you know, very, very depressed. So, I mean, that's again an X right there.
But you're not yeah. naming names?
I unless you guys want to name names, no, I'm not going to name names.
we may at some
talk
point.
About companies that we actually mm-hmm. like, unless, of yeah. course, we're doing a Your Stock, Our Take on them. Then,
yeah,
we'll no, probably review a couple of the companies that we, you know, on the podcast, we're certainly going to review them for clients, but we'll review a few of them in there, particularly if they can be instructive into. Some kind of education on the markets too, like what we look for. I mean, today the company that the question got sent in on, you know, is kind of a juxtaposition to another company that we have in coverage. And one is the way not to do it. One is the way to do it. Right. And, you know, we like to provide those type of instructive segments on this show as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Before we move on from the conference, unless you guys had anything else to say, I did want to just say that it was pretty cool. I'll share my screen here quickly. It was pretty cool because me and Ryan were in line to grab some food. And I looked up at the sky and I saw there was a plane and then this other thing in the sky. And I was like, what is that? Ryan, like that's not a plane. And he looked at me and he starts laughing and he's like, I don't know what you said, but it's probably along the lines of you're drunk, Brennan.
No, I told some people behind me it was an asteroid coming.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah.
And you can see the trajectory that it was not an asteroid coming.
No, usually asteroids come planet. From yeah. space and not. Yeah.
But they were freaking out yeah. and I said, well, no, it's, you know, going from the planet towards the atmosphere. So yeah. it's probably
it
not an
freaking
asteroid.
Freaking out?
Oh, just some people behind
yeah,
us.
Yeah, just some
people. Well, we weren't in that actual food line. We were in food in a cup line, I think, Brennan, like at yeah. that point. So yeah. probably getting a beverage and the people behind us had several.
Yeah, so that's true. That's
they
true.
Were but believing anyways, that was coming.
There's
to
a picture. It was Brett confirmed that it was the Falcon 9, correct? This,
yeah, I believe so.
Yes, it was Elon's Starling. Falcon 9 taking off, which was it was pretty cool to see in person.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah, that was sure. that was interesting. Yeah.
To throw that out there.
Yeah, and they had the drone show. Maybe we'll put up the drone show.
Space.
Pardon?
The first time I've seen a rocket launched into space.
Yes.
Live. Right. The guy who was standing in front of me in the line lives around there. He says that he's seen it almost half a dozen times. I think.
Yeah. Well, cool. Must be nice to
must be nice. Yeah.
I don't know. No, that's cool. It was cool. And there was a drone show too, which was fairly cool. Maybe we can put up footage so you don't have to look at our faces while we're talking here, yeah. Which was always great, right? Okay. Well, I think, do we have a poll that we had from last week? Do we want to review that?
Yep. From, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
We asked, which of the following do you view as the biggest risk to your investments? So coming in at the highest, which is the one which I would expect to be the highest, was inflation and interest rates at 53% of the poll. Then followed by internal government policy changes or stagnation, so no policy changes, at 18%. Followed by military conflicts at 16%. Then technological disruptions like AI at 8%. Then geopolitical tensions like trade wars at 5%. It's kind of funny, because a few years ago, I think if you asked that, trade wars probably would have been at the top for most people.
Definitely.
When you were seeing the China-US trade war, that probably would have been near the top, if not the top, and inflation wasn't even there. So you wouldn't have even seen it on here.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you guys answer it anyway?
I didn't. I mean, I have some exposure to the Middle East in my own portfolio. So, I mean, I'd maybe say military conflicts or, inflation and interest rates is probably what I would say. But that's about it.
Yeah. Over the past year, rate increases, or the past, 18 months, 24, have been actually a risk and an opportunity. So and we talk about that at our upcoming seminars, how cash rich companies that, are on one side of the equation. And I did an appearance on Money Talks over this past weekend too. So we can call out that if you want to go to moneytalks.com, or is it moneytalks.ca?
I'll put a link either way in the
description. Just do it, because I think there's one you didn't used to want to go to. It's Mike's Money Talks.
Mike's
Money Talks. That's what it is. Jeez. Anyway, so go to that and you can see the appearance there. But we talked about the effect that the interest rate rise has had on small caps. And I gave a couple examples there of the net cash company versus the net debt company. And it's been a real opportunity to invest in some quality businesses that had net cash in them. And we've seen significant gains. So make sure you go to the right website, Mike's Money Talks. And the Money Talk Show .ca. There you go. Perfect. Okay. Was there anything else we wanted to talk about the Roth conference? Good event. We have a report coming out. I'm not sure if we're doing a report on the event, but we do have a report with some companies that were there that we're covering at the report. And we'll have a client notification. We're going to have a ton of updates coming out. We've had a ton of companies a report over the past week, so those updates will be coming out.
Yep.
Okay. Well, let's hit the mailbag. Okay, the company I'm going to talk about is Dye & Durham Limited, DND on the TSX, trades around $15.54, just over $1 billion market cap. It says nil yield. It's just a very small yield. It's 0.004%. For some reason, they pay a dividend annually. It's really absolutely useless and inappropriate given the debt. We'll kind of go into that in a second. What does Dye & Durham do? They're a provider of practice management software, data solutions, and payment technology to law firms and businesses. The company has over 60,000 clients in Canada and international markets. It's based in Toronto, Canada. Now, I'm going to give you a snapshot here of the business financially over the past 10 years. Hopefully this will help. We can see revenue growth look great for 9 years, from 1.9 million in 2011 to 478.8 million in 2022, before declining to 451 million in 2023. Operating income shows a similar trend, 9 years of strong growth before dropping off in 2023. If we look at debt here, sharp increase through the period with a huge step up from 2021 to 2022. And the interest expense just keeps mounting with higher and higher debt and higher interest rates over that period. Debt was essentially to fund a massive acquisition spree. Many were consummated at elevated prices, I would say. Now let's look at the shares outstanding over this period too. You can see just significant continued increase in the share count outstanding of the business. This doesn't include, I believe, a recent financing or perhaps on the trailing 12-month figure there when you get up to about $67 million. We do include that. Now, let's look at the second quarter highlights here. Revenues, it shows up 17%, but that's after taking out a recent sale or divestiture of the TM group there. Revenues, if you include that into the business, were up just 3% in the period. The net loss, $34.8 million. It's stable compared to the same period of last year. Adjusted EBITDA, $60 million. That's an increase of just 4% over that period. Let's look at the valuations. On an EV to EBITDA basis, despite the share price being far off from its high, significantly depressed, is about 17.65. The EV to EBITDA forward, these are based on some, what I would say are some very optimistic estimates, is around 9. The PE, because there is no earnings, you can't really calculate that. So let's look at recent news here, and this continues a trend for the business. They announced they'd entered into an agreement with Canaccord to essentially do a financing, issued 10.4 million shares at $12.10, raising $126 million. What do they intend to do with the net proceeds? They intend to pay off and repay some of their debt. It's consistent with the company's stated goals over the past year to reduce their leverage ratio to less than 4x. The company is not issuing shares for growth purposes, but again, to pay down debt. Shareholders continue to pay for a company that tried to expand far too fast and over-leveraged itself. Dianderm is likely into a cycle of either asset sales, we saw that already, shrinking the business, and or continued equity dilution to pay down debt. So my quick conclusion here is Dianderm has some very useful, in some cases well-reviewed, software servicing the legal industry. As a public entity, however, the company has been managed very poorly, and its current debt situation leaves the business playing defense. We would just monitor the business at present, but are not buying it. I'm going to say that investing within a sector, or generally speaking, the decision to buy or pass on a stock takes into account the alternatives for where your capital can go. In the case of D&D, our current coverage essentially includes 3 to 4 companies or names with net cash in the software sector with higher organic growth, and in most cases, equivalent to lower multiples. Companies that are not over-leveraged with cash just have so many other ways to deploy their capital that can create value for shareholders. They can buy back shares, pay dividends, invest in the business, or buy other businesses to grow. We prefer to play in that pool rather than the one where we're speculating on deleverage, selling off assets to improve the current poor situation. The more you play in the net cash pool, the better your chance of success over the long term. And that's me on my soapbox right at the end.
Listen to you.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at that debt situation, you've got debt continuing to increase, substantial levels of debt continuing to increase, while then revenues and operating income are going down and you're still not profitable. So we've seen situations where companies have levered up their balance sheets in order to make a big acquisition. This can be a risky proposition, but if you're able to then pay down the debt with operating cash flow, free cash flow from those new assets, then it makes sense. Then that's a successful, accretive transaction. But having to then go back to the market, raise shares at, I mean, it's the share price is way down. The valuation is still not cheap. So I guess at the current valuation, it's not that bad for the company, but still you're raising shares just to pay down debt. You should be paying down debt with free cash flow. Obviously, there is something wrong with the capital allocation strategy there, and they're just beginning to realize that.
Yeah, I mean, just to give you an idea too, between 2020, I believe, and 2022, the company's shares were basically, you know, above the $40 range, slightly below, but, you know, hit 50 something at some point. It trades in the $15 range today. That's when it was going on, you know, this acquisition spree, promising tremendous growth. And you know, it really just levered itself out to do this, not on a responsible basis. And then, you know, shareholders who bought into this blue sky potential tremendous, and it was in a lower debt environment, but into that tremendous just growth, buying businesses at any price, buying at high valuations, not focusing on organic growth. Well, you can see what's happened to the share price. It's significant. You know, it's gone down from the $40 range to the $15 range. Now they're having to, I mean, they raised capital, significant capital, diluting shareholders at $12. I mean, that again, not only is paying off like 10% or something of their debt too, this cycle will have to continue. How do you now, there isn't a ton of organic growth here, it appears. So if you continue to have to now, how do you grow? Do you buy more businesses? Well, you can't, you've got too much debt. Do you issue shares? Well, you know, you say you're trading at significantly low forward valuations. Why would you want to continue to issue shares? And they, again, they had to issue shares just to start to pay down some of this high, high interest debt. It's just expanding too fast, getting ahead of your skis, so to speak, before, you know, and not wanting to grow out of cash flow. And, you know, you end up with a business that looked great at one point, on the surface, but really the underlying business there and the structure and the way you're building that business isn't sustainable. And then the house of cards gets pulled out from under you. And here you have this situation that you're in where it's going to be very difficult for them to grow going forward. And it's all about playing defense, trying to pay down debt, selling off assets. There may be an argument made here that the sum of the parts is worth more than what you're looking at now in the market. We like to analyze cash flow, and you know, cash flow is decreasing right now, and the business, you know, is paying a dividend for some reason. I mean, just the capital allocation discipline from this management team, which again is changing, it looks like, is just poor. And we want to see good capital allocation, and it's just not there. Hasn't been there for Dynger. All right, let's move on. Aaron, you're taking a look at Lululemon, a company that has been well managed over time and really looked like had a decent quarter. But the outlook, again, when you're priced at premium levels, which Lululemon has been priced at, Aaron's going to get into that. You know, you get punished in the market if there's any degree of weakness, and that's probably, it looks like what happened here. But Aaron has taken a far better look at it than I will, and he's going to look at it now.
Lululemon, this is a company. We took a look at this company, I think about 6 months ago. Certainly, it's a company that does not need an introduction. It's a global brand, athletic apparel, yoga, running, footwear, accessories. They have 711 company-owned stores in 17 countries. They have e-commerce, wholesale. And this is a Vancouver founded company back in 1998. So let's take a look at the company over the last year here. Share price performance over the last 12 months, if we just look at that, is actually reasonably good. About 24% is what the return has been. But what we can see here is just recently, since the start of the year, company's really taken a downward turn. So Lulu's down 23% from its highs, which were just at the end of 2023, but down 18% just after the release of its Q4 2023 results, which were just issued recently. So what happened here? Let's take a look, first of all, at the financials. So Q4 2023, at face value, the numbers look very good. 16% growth in revenue. Gross margins were up about 200 basis points. A 16% growth again in adjusted operating income, and about 20% growth in adjusted EPS. Same thing can be said for the full year results, with revenue up 19%. Good expansion of gross margins, up 240 basis points, operating income up 25%, and adjusted EPS up 27%. Okay, so what happened here? You know, essentially, this is not this pullback in the share price is not about what happened in the fourth quarter, but rather about what the expectations are for the current year, 2024. So the company did issue 2024 guidance. They're expecting net revenue to be about $10.8 billion. So that's growth in the range of 10 to 11%, excluding the fact that there's going to be an extra week in 2024. So they're looking at 10, 11% growth in revenue. And then as well about 10, 11% growth in earnings per share, including the extra week. One of the things that the management did talk about is that they are seeing a slowdown in the US market, a shift in consumer behavior, and this has led to a slower start to the year. So now when we look at these numbers at face value, you know, 10, 11% growth in revenue, in earnings per share, that's not too bad. But we also have to consider that this is coming off of earnings growth nearing 30%, right? So even though we're still getting positive earnings growth expected for 2024, it's really come down from what investors are accustomed to, that kind of 20 to 27% range. And then with the comments about a slowdown in the US, this has really just injected some uncertainty into the investor and sentiment for the stock price. And what we've seen now is the shares pull back. Now, in terms of just the outlook and the commentary, the company opened 56 net new stores during the year, bringing the number up to 711 stores. They're repurchasing shares, repurchased about 554 million of shares. And then they also have their growth targets, which they refer to as Power of 3x2. This is a plan that they've laid out. They laid it out in 2021, and this is to double the size of the business from 2021 to 2026. So bringing revenues, net revenues, up from 6.25 to 12.5 billion. So it's essentially doubling their revenues over a five-year period. Now, what this equates to is growth, average compound growth over these 5 years of 15% per year. Now, if you were to take their revenues reported in 2023 and extrapolate that out to 2026, they only need to grow the revenues at about 9% per year to hit this target. So they're actually still well on track to hit the target. There's no issue there. Perhaps what's worked against them somewhat is that they were ahead of their targets for the first 2 years. They overperformed. Investors got used to that, expecting that they would continue to overperform. Now it looks like growth is reverting somewhat, even though it's still positive, even though they're still on track to hit their targets. And again, this has just created some uncertainty around the future growth rate. Looking at the balance sheet, very solid balance sheet. It's a net cash business, $2.2 billion in cash and cash equivalents, $1.4 billion in leases. So net cash balance of about $800 million. And then in terms of the valuation, based on the guidance for 2024, they're trading at about 28 times earnings. So, you know, they've come down from around the 35 times relative to Lululemon's historic valuation. 28 times is certainly reasonable. However, again, this is also on the back of lower growth expectations, and it's still a premium to the market. So that's something to consider. What's our take on Lululemon? Well, we believe the fundamentals still continue to be strong. They are continuing to grow. They're on track with their previous target. They have a fantastic global brand with a lot of customer loyalty and a nice net cash balance. So they're sitting on a solid financial foundation. But there is the slowdown that has hit the share price, a warning for management. The valuation is not completely unreasonable, but it's still on the pricey side. So we do think long-term it's an opportunity to invest in a strong global brand, but it's really still not cheap. We're on the sidelines with Lululemon right now. We'll continue to watch it. Maybe if the shares continue to pull back, there could be a value opportunity to buy a great company.
Yeah, it's a good summary. I'm a customer, and I noted when I got home from our conference, there was a new pair of Lululemon shoes and something else, not mine, but sitting on the in the
So are you a customer, or somebody else in your house a customer?
Well, there's I have some Lululemon stuff
that you purchased yourself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've got some.
And then, I also have Lululemon things, but it's my wife who's the customer. So
yeah, no, and Candace is the customer, but I have a pair of shorts and a vest or something like that. Yeah. Yeah,
it's high quality stuff, it's good.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it is definitely pricey though. Like,
and that's why you got to wait, or just have a sister who sends you a text every single time there's a sale. So my sister will wait till things are on sale and she's like, hey, you should buy these.
So we happen to have an in. We know somebody who flies for the family. So like the Lululemon, the guy who runs it. So yeah. There's a discount. Floating around. All right. So what are we doing? Where are we moving to?
Brett.
Mm-hmm. You're moving to me.
That's true. Is there anything else we wanted to talk about with Lulu? I mean, it's a good company. Like Aaron said, the valuations, even after the drop, are a little high.
It's not horrible.
It's
fair value given what's been going on with the company.
Even though it's an iconic brand now and it you know, has such brand power, I always get scared about fashion companies because brands, if, you know, 2 years from now, the kids, like if, you know, there's an 18-year-old in the house says, I don't like Lululemon, and everybody in that group says, I don't like it. Even if it's great clothing, it can move against you and suddenly you're not able to have a premium price. But, you know, Lululemon seems to have skirted all of that to date. So, I mean, it's hard to bet against them over the long term. Mm-hmm. All right, Brett. You're going, what's the company called? RCM, right?
RCM Technologies.
Take it away.
RCM Technologies. We got a question on it from a client. They are symbol RCMT on the NASDAQ. The company offers specialized staffing solutions for specialty healthcare, engineering, and life sciences, as well as information technology. The company offers either short-term or per-project solutions, as well as long-term multi-contract positions over a longer period of time. The company is primarily in the U.S., but they do have some operations in Canada and Europe at this time. The question asks specifically, are they seeing catalysts in expanding into different regions? They specifically name South America, as well as does the company have a economic moat, which I'll get to in a few minutes. The stock is trading up substantially over the past year, up 110%, and is trading at $22.30 a share at a market cap of $177 million. Looking at the financials for the last year, so 2023, starting with income statement, revenue decreased 7.5% to $263 million from $285 million. This is still an increase compared to 2021 of 29.1%, as the company did see a substantial increase between the 2021 in 2022 period, and it has since slightly come down since that peak. However, gross margin still remains steady at 29.1%, which is good to see, as sometimes when you see that big peak and then the contraction after, you'll start to see margin slip as well. But that doesn't seem to be the case, at least for the overall business. You have seen a bit of the mix between the three segments, where a couple of them have rose and one of them declined. And so that is something you do want to watch when you want to dive into it a bit deeper if you are considering this investment, is really watch those margins to see if they're contracting or expanding. Operating income fell 17.7% to $23.7 million due to that lower gross profit, slightly offset by lower SG&A by about $1 million. Net income fell 19.4% to $16.8 million or $1.96 per diluted share. Due to the previous reasons, as well as they have higher interest expense. When you see a high interest expense like this, from going from $400,000 to $1.4 million, you want to look at that, and we want a moment. The net margin was 6.3% for 2023, which is a decrease from 7.3% from 2022. Like I said, we want to look at the debt and why that's the interest is increasing. So RCM, they hold a cash position of $6.3 million, and they have a line of credit at the end of 2023 of $30.8 million. So that's a net debt position of $24.5 million. As well, you can see that line of credit increased substantially from $8.8 million. So big increase. So the line of credit is where the interest expense is coming from, partially due to the size, but more so to do with the interest rates as the debt is floating. The effective interest rate for 2023 was 6.5% compared to 2.2% in 2022. So nearly three times that just interest rate, even if their debt was steady, and that accounts for the majority of that difference. As well as the size of outstanding credit line does fluctuate quite a fair amount throughout the year. And since the balance sheet is only, remember, a snapshot in time at the end of the quarter or the year in this case, and it being 3.5 times the size, but they're turning that over multiple times per year, you need to look a bit deeper, and then you realize, oh, it's more just the interest rate went up versus the actual debt level. So even though you are seeing that substantial increase under borrowings of lines of credit, it does fluctuate a lot throughout the year. And the majority of the actual interest expense increase was purely just because of interest rate increases, not the actual debt level. But that is still obviously something you want to watch if you see the borrowing stay high over an extended period of time. But if it does fluctuate a lot in the quarter, you need to give them some leeway because it is a snapshot in time. Part of the reason for that increased line of credit, though, is a higher accounts receivable as the company has had slower collections, but did note in their conference call that the collections have at least increased pace during Q1 so far. This is something to watch out for as companies that have issues collecting can quickly have issues cascade that they need to cover. They need to take more debt on to cover shortfalls. And then that is in a high interest rate environment. Obviously, that creates a leg on earning. And then eventually, if they aren't able to collect, you could see write-downs, which means they're either not going to collect the full amount or less, or as for the accounting principles, it might be a past 90 days, even if they are still, in reality, expecting to collect all, a delayed collection. As well, hitting the cash balance, the company did repurchase a substantial amount of shares, 1.8 million shares for $25.8 million, which obviously does put a bit more pressure on the cash reserves because that's a substantial amount for a company this size. So on to the questions. So for expansion at this time, the company doesn't have a presence in South America. They did mention in their Q3 conference call that it was of interest to expand there, but that would be down the line. It's really just in its early phases, it seems like. And that would be, if we were to call management, that'd be something we would ask, is how they're going to expand and what areas and so on. However, in 2023, they did have their energy services division, which is under their engineering, open an office in Germany. So as far as regional expansion, at least for 2023, Europe might be the place to look, and that could be the place to look going forward, as they already do have a bit of presence there. It wouldn't be a full new region to them. They have Serbia as well as Germany. And then, but past geographically, what you would want to watch as well is what specialty areas or what staffing they are really providing. Are they expanding their breadth? Are they expanding vertically? Not just the geographic region, because obviously within the US, they can have staffing solutions for a myriad of different industries. As well, a comment on the economic mode of the company. The staffing industry as a whole is very competitive, quite fragmented. It can depend on the region and so on. And that's why you'll see things like tuck-in acquisitions, bolt-in acquisitions, that sense, because they can just grab something, small company, and put it in their house. But that's also shows kind of the weakness, because it is a very low moat, because you have all these companies, you have quite a bit of competition. So for example, they offer us nursing staffing solutions, which is highly competitive. We actually have had, I think, a couple of companies under our coverage over the last couple of years within just nursing solutions. Just to give you an idea, it is a competitive space. So you do see, if you're looking at a moat, an economic mode that would lower it, you're seeing a fragmented, which normally means competition is a bit higher, but then they can offset a bit with those more advanced industries. So if you have something very advanced, you have the specialty within that industry that will provide the higher margins, it will be a bit more restrictive as the industry is more niche, and that's where you'll really see a better mode. But it really depends on the service and what specific ones, and you see quite a bit of variance just even within the company. So the company as a whole, I'd probably say as a weaker, maybe a bit stronger than some other staffing solutions, because they do have those specialties. But overall, it's not a super strong moat like you'll see in something completely different, like a NVIDIA or something like that, where it's obviously a strong moat at this time. But moving to valuations, the company trades at a trailing P of 11.4 times, an EV EBITDA of 8.1 times, and a trailing price to free cash flow of 17.8 times. The valuation, I would say, is reasonable, maybe a touch too high, as the company has had great results over the past, from that 2021 to the 2022, but that was largely due to the COVID bump more than anything in nursing solutions. But the growth before that was really non-existent to low, and you can see a 10-year graph that I have popped up here. You'll see this is revenue and net income per share or EPS, and you can see it's relatively flat. And then you'll see that slight decline at the start because no one was really working in that 2021. So obviously solutions had an issue. And then you see that big jump up in 2021 and 2022. And obviously now we're coming back down a bit, but management still does, they're still guiding, at least in their conference call, double-digit adjusted EBITDA growth for the year. So that will be something you'd want to track going forward. Are they actually going to hit that growth level? But moving to and concluding, I should say, the company really just came off a great 2022, and 2023 is still good compared to 2021 or previously, but it is starting to show some weaknesses. They do actually have a downsizing of their contracts because the people who they were supplying the employees to had their project size decrease. So it obviously reduces their headcount that they supply. And just seeing issues like that crop up. And then they have the interest rate sensitivity and just the natural part of the business being margins are low. So when you have that interest expense, they'll start to strip away. And then if they have a bit of the revenue decline, you have that loss of economies of scale, which can hit it as well. As well, you'd want to watch out for more than just the GAAP earnings. Like I was saying with the accounts receivable, you want to watch if are they collecting, are they seeing any write-downs, are they seeing delays? Any discussion around that is important to watch with this. Because if they stop collecting, it doesn't matter what their GAAP earnings were for the prior quarter. Once that write-down comes and they no longer expect to collect, not saying it will happen, that obviously means those previous GAAP earnings were overstated and then the valuation in reality should have been higher than what it is. So really, I would say the valuation is reasonable, maybe a bit high given the risk, but the concern would be if you see a continued contraction of earnings back to low single digits, mid high single digits, similar to historic levels. But for now, I really just monitor the company to see if they can come out of 2023 a bit stronger, or sorry, 2024 a bit stronger.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like they really had to lap, you know, like such a tight labor market in 2022. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, like there's a company that's been on our radar for some time, Hudson Global Inc. And, you know, looking back at my analyst notes as we were doing, you know, our sweep through, you know, thousands of US companies, like, you know, the company was net cash. It was trading at $17.30 at the time, $17.30. Again, they're a talent solutions or recruitment provider. They are profitable. And I wrote here, you know, they could benefit from the work shortages that we were seeing, but maybe more of a short-term trade. So that's the thing where, again, we're not traders, we're long-term investors. That's the thing we saw, you know, even if you were looking at Hudson's financials here, we saw a good 2021. We saw a really great 2022. Well, now we're in 2023 and they're not able to lap. So we're all of a sudden, or they're not able to, you know, post higher numbers in 2022. So, you know, yeah, the stock went up, you know, Hudson went from, I think $17 to 30, 34 or somewhere in there, but it's back down to 18, you know, it's right back where it is. So that's the thing. And trying to predict that a labor market is going to remain tight for a significant period of time is anyone's guess, in my opinion. But yeah, I think that's really the story there is the fact that, you know, such a good 2022 with the tight labor market, you know, the amount of analyst calls that we would jump in and that would be, you know, our question, how was hiring, you know, and the amount of difficulties that they were going through was pretty tremendous. But you know, trying to lap those, you know, record numbers in 2023, obviously, you know, a lot of these companies can't do that. And looking to 2024, like you said, Brett, you know, like that's really going to be where the rubber meets the road to see, you know, what they can do.
We're moving on to Brennan's segment, and Brennan's going to look at the VIX because Aaron is very interested in Brennan's segment. That's why we're moving forward.
I am interested. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Now you're putting the pressure on him.
Ah, there's no pressure.
No, there is.
Uh-oh, now I am shaking in my booties over here. I actually brought this segment up to the guys in an Uber ride in California. And I was like, I think this would be a good segment to do. So what is the VIX? Well, the VIX or CBOE Volatility Index was launched in 2003 and is known as the Fear Index, which projects the probable range of movement or volatility in the U.S. equity markets, specifically the S&P 500, above or below its current level in the immediate future. So how is the VIX measured? So the VIX measures the implied volatility of put and call options on the S&P 500 for the next 30 days. And to make sure that listeners understand the concept of implied volatility, it is the amount of volatility that is priced into option prices, as one of the underlying factors of option pricing models is volatility. So essentially, by looking at the price of options over the next 30 days in the market, we can directly calculate how much volatility investors are pricing in. So when implied volatility is high, the VIX level is high and the range of likely values is quite broad. And when implied volatility is low, the VIX level is low and the range is narrow. So as you can see in the image on the screen, which is directly from the S&P 500 website, it shows the ranges of the VIX index and generally how much volatility is being priced in. So here's the VIX index going back to 2008. And as you can see, there were very large spikes in 08, 09, of course, during the financial crisis, and as well as during the 2020 pandemic, or at the beginning of the pandemic. And right now, the index is sitting at about 13.2. So that indicates to us that there is low expected volatility being priced into the market right now. But to take this one step further, the VIX is reported as an annualized number. So taking the current level of 13.2, this indicates to us that over the next year, based on the implied volatility of options over the next 30 days, over the next year, the market is pricing in a plus or minus 13% move in the S&P 500 with about 68% confidence. And just so you understand where the 68% confidence comes from, this is based on the empirical rule from statistics, which essentially states that 99.7% of normally distributed data falls within three standard deviations of the mean. And again, if anyone has taken a statistics class in university, this will make sense. But essentially, because the VIX is looking at the annualized magnitude of a one standard deviation move away from the mean, essentially, we can say that there is a 68% confidence that there will be a plus or minus 13% deviation from the mean over the next year. Now, we could also de-annualize the VIX index level to get the expected monthly implied volatility by dividing the annualized index percentage term by the square root of 12, since there are 12 months in a year. And as shown on the screen, the S&P has this really good table on their website showing the calculations which de-annualizes the expected implied volatility to monthly. So if we stick to our current example with where the index is at currently at 13.2, this means that over the next month, the monthly implied volatility for the S&P 500 is plus or minus 3.8%. So that's what the market is expecting the S&P 500 to essentially do over the next month. We'll see if that comes true. Now, to conclude here, you know, hopefully after this quick discussion, the next time you hear a talking head on BNN or CNBC reference the level of VIX, you can make sense of what it actually means rather than just some random number. Now, looking at some actual use cases of the VIX, it includes diversifying or hedging a portfolio. As if we think of VIX or the volatility as an actual asset class, the VIX has negative correlation with the S&P 500. So the more the S&P 500 falls, the more the VIX rises. And therefore, investors who have a long position in equities could use the VIX to hedge their position if they speculate that there will be some weakness in the market. Now, they could do this by taking a long position on the VIX with options or futures, or potentially use a VIX ETF. Now, another use is trading or essentially speculating for profit. Now, some investors, or realistically, I should say, or call them traders in this case, they'll bet on a change in the market cycle and a reversion to the mean. Now, for example, following a period of weakness in the market, an investor will sell VIX-linked products following a weak period in equity markets and will purchase VIX-linked products in anticipation of future periods of weakness. And I included this image on the slide here, which I thought was kind of funny, as it really shows how popular the short the VIX trade has become, especially when I was, you know, finishing up university. Maybe it's just anecdotal because it was in my mind and I was becoming a finance bro. But anyways, the image is live from a 2018 college football game. And of course, someone, again, probably a finance bro, decided to make a sign that says, "The other team's coach doesn't short the VIX," which I assume he is thinking that's probably a bad thing. Either way, I thought it was comical. So let's be realistic here. The million-dollar question is whether the VIX truly has predictive power, And what does it tell us about how we should manage our money? Well, first off, the answer is yes. There is evidence that indicates that the VIX has predictive power, and implied volatility is the best gauge to forecast volatility of equities. But the second piece here, whether it should impact how we manage our money, realistically, it shouldn't. If you're a short-term trader, you care about the VIX a lot, probably. But for long-term investors, it really doesn't provide much useful information. Month-to-month, even year-to-year, volatility events are largely random. You want to focus on harvesting the long-term sources of expected returns that can drive your portfolio. How volatile the market happens to be over the next month or so doesn't have any effect on what you should be doing. So that's my piece on VIX. Hopefully, you know, the next time you hear those talking heads when they try to make themselves sound smart by, you know, talking about the level, you can actually, you know, one up them and be like, oh, that means, you know, 13% plus or minus volatility over the next year with a 68% confidence. So you can one up them. Anyways, that's my piece.
Do you know when that picture was taken, roughly?
2018. It was.
Do you know what part of the year? Because it matters a lot.
No, I don't know.
So, yeah, at the start of 2018, or like in, I found an article, February 6th,
yep,
is the short VIX ETFs, effectively all the ones on the market, actually all blew up. Because there was a sudden rise in volatility. And so all those just effectively went to zero overnight, and it liquidated a bunch of people, which caused them more issues as well at the same time, because they are ETFs and there's a lot of complexities just even within the ETFs, because you need to remember when you're buying the ETF. So what you're really doing when you're buying a VIX ETF is you are buying the VIX underlying VIX futures, which will roll every month, which is why you see that constant decline. But then what is a VIX future? It is a future on an index, and that index is based on options, so another derivative on top of the S&P 500, another index. Yep. So it's a complicated chain, and a lot of people don't realize what they're actually investing in. Brendan did a good job of explaining it, but even the ETFs will add another layer, and then you'll have people trade options on top of that. So you have, what, 5-6 layers of instruments on top of each other, and you saw in 2018, actually, effectively, I think literally all of the U.S., inverse VIX or short VIX ETFs all blew up, or I think they're technically ETNs, so electronic traded notes, in whatever sort. They effectively all disappeared overnight because they went to zero.
Well, that's great context, Brett.
Yeah,
and that's funny. I didn't know that happened right in 2018.
Yeah, so that might have actually been it was a bad coach.
Yeah. And that's the thing, even when it comes to ETFs, like especially, you know, like we get a lot of questions on like covered call ETFs and whatnot. A lot of the times they can get really convoluted. I mean, obviously, you know, these are probably some of the worst, you know, but really like lay investors probably should steer clear, you know, from things like this, just because, again, they're quite difficult to understand.
Mm-hmm. Just Google the 2018 blow up, because a lot of it was retail investing, which was at the worst end of that trade.
Yeah.
And that's just another example of why investing in things that you don't understand is always just going to set you up for disaster every time. You know, I remember after the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, what were really big at the time were those 3x leverage.
Yeah.
Inverse ETFs, right? So you're basically making money when the market goes down, and they were levered 3x, right? And we did a segment. We didn't have a podcast back then, but we wrote an article on the, what was strange is that the market was trending down, yet these ETFs were still losing money, and it didn't really make any sense. And the reason for that was, I won't get high into the math, but because these were like 3x leveraged, they were essentially, you know, if the market just went down in a straight line, they would have made money. But because there was a lot of volatility, the market would pop up, then the market would go down. It actually ended up, the mathematics of it actually ended up making these negative investments. So they were actually losing money, in spite of the fact that the market was trending in the direction that investors expected it to trend. So It's, you know, it's one of those things. I don't think it's that important to get too deep into it, because when things are so, when these products are so complex, it's just best to avoid them. You know, if it's something you don't perfectly understand or understand with a high degree of certainty, just stay away from it.
Yeah.
I mean, we have investors that talk to us about investing in individual stocks, just the basic investment in investing in individual stock, and they don't understand really what they're doing investing in the stock. And then in the same conversation, they'll talk about, but what about options for me? And it's like they don't even understand what the option might be based off of. And then they're going a further step from there. It just, it always blows my mind that people want to overcomplicate, but they've heard from an ad or from a friend that this is, you need to do this. You need to be do this in, to be investing. You don't have to understand everything, but you know, have a basic understanding. You'll be a better investor and over the long
term. It's the quick money too, that, you know, entices people towards, you know, options or, you know, even shorting the VIX or whatever. It's, you know, that enticement of, oh, you know, quick money, where realistically, again, it takes time for good businesses to grow. And, you know, there's nothing worse to be trying to go against time value or whatever when you are on options.
Yeah. So you have the quick gain, but you have the quick loss too. Exactly. And you never hear about the quick loss, but yeah, it's more often than not where they end up. Mm-hmm. Okay. I tried to, well, you probably don't know this, but I tried to end the show without hearing that from Brennan, but we're going to quickly get into, our webinars are live, up and coming webinars. We've got them April 2nd and April 11th. Those are Simplify Your Stock Portfolio for 2024, buying 15 to 25 great businesses. Essentially, everything you want to know about building a simple 15, 25 stock portfolio. And we'll give you 6 to 8 profitable stocks that you can buy today to go in that portfolio. We'll talk about thematic investing, investing in AI, Bitcoin and crypto ETFs, a review of our report in this sector, investing in commodities, is it a trade or a long-term buy? All of these things, how the big banks are killing your portfolio, Canadians' roadmap to investing in U.S. opportunities, RSP, TFSA season, we're there right now. We'll talk about those, the basic products in that area and define them for your portfolio. So get your tickets now. There's an early bird, $29.95. The VIP gets you 2 special reports. That would be our Canadian Dividend All-Star Preview Report and our top U.S. Microcap Profitable Growth Stock Report. So those each alone are $5.99. You're going to get that with the $79.95 ticket for attending. There's also our complete VIP Stock Portfolio Building Package. It gives you that full 25 stock VIP portfolio. It's regularly around $3,600. It's $19.99. You're going to get that. That comes with that 5-hour webinar on April 6th, starting at 11 a.m. Pacific. And you're going to get that annual VIP membership, full VIP portfolio review, 3 analyst calls a year. There's 2 VIP portfolio reviews, any special report, essentially all the research condensed into one portfolio for our clients. So if you are serious, if you're an individual or family who's serious about having Keystone help them build a simple 15 to 25 stock portfolio, want a complete, easy to follow system which tells you what stocks to buy, how many, and when to buy them, that is the seminar and package for you. So hopefully we'll see you there. We'll answer all your questions as well in the Q&As that we have at the end of those, and help you on a better path to building that simple 15 to 25 stock portfolio. As always, keep your questions coming into our Your Stock, Our Take segments. If you're viewing this right now on YouTube, smash that subscribe button. And if you want to review us on iTunes, rate and review us on there. We'd like that. As always, only positive reviews. Okay, that's going to end our show for this week. And as always, I wish you profitable investing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.